Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
They might talk about human music, film, books, football and box sets, exercise and maybe even food. Trivia and sport, politics and health, sometimes well-being too. On The Life with Brian. On The Life with Brian.
Hello, you seem to have joined us again on Life with Brian, the podcast hosted by Sir Alex Ferguson's favourite player, Brian McClair, with myself, Mark and Matthew on backing vocals. How are you both doing now that this mammoth football season has finally ended?
I think you'll find that his favourite player was Eric Cantona. I might have been his favourite player for a very brief period of time.
He's not bitter about it at all.
Not that much.
All good this end, Mark. Thanks. Good to see everyone.
And as usual, we have a special guest. He's a singer, songwriter and broadcaster who is best known for fronting the hugely successful band Deacon Blue for the past 30-something years. Of course, I'm talking about Ricky Ross. Welcome, Ricky. How's it going?
Very well. Thank you for that something. That was good. That covered a multitude of sins, that 30-something.
We paint with broad strokes here.
Yes, that's good.
Let's begin with, for me, Ricky, when I was looking through various different things, I fell upon this, and I bought this in 87, and I immediately recorded it so I could listen to it in the car, because you couldn't play LPs in the car, but I didn't have a CD player, and I had decided that summer that I would go leave Glasgow and go down to Manchester to sign for Manchester United, and they gave me a car, and I used to travel up and down in this car. And the day before pre-season training, I was driving, the evening before, I'm driving down to the hotel that Manchester United had put me up in. And I was listening to this album all the way down. And I kept rewinding and listening to various different songs that I liked, you know, Dignity, Chocolate Girl in particular. And I got in this car, they given me, had a petrol gauge, but didn't have any warning light on it. And I ran out of petrol. But only realised after I'd got a refill. So I ran out of petrol on the motorway heading into Manchester to pull over onto the hard shoulder, and I had to get out of the car and walk down to the telephone and see if somebody could come out and help. And a guy came out in a pickup about half an hour later, and he put in just enough fuel for me to get from there to the hotel. But I had to pay, I had no money. And a checkbook, and this album of Deacon Blues cost me in total £56. If I hadn't been listening to it, I'm sure I would have had enough fuel, you know, to have limped to the hotel. Was just the very next turn off, right by the next junction. So I ran out of fuel, about 100 yards from the junction. So that's my my first and earliest moment of having an experience with you and your band.
Well, I'm sorry about the cost, but I'm thinking of a famous story that I remember reading about your old boss, whose excuse for being on the hard shoulder was he had the skitters. So
I was speeding. That's what it was.
At least you didn't have that excuse.
No.
Petrol seems more legit.
I mean, I've not been in the car that often with him driving, but he's one of the worst drivers I've ever come across. And just not long after that, I was driving back from a weekend trip back home, and we're driving down the M6, and I noticed there was a queue of traffic. And when we got to the front of the traffic, there'd been a little bump, and a Jaguar had shunted a car in front. And as I went past, it was Alec Ferguson that had been driving the Jaguar. He'd been messing about, trying to fix the radio or something, not paying attention. Traffic slowed down and he ran right into the back of whoever it was in front of him. But he had so many things like that, you know, but that kind of thing of being able to get away with, he got away with that speeding thing at that particular moment. I mean, he got away with it. That, so the guy who was doing it was brilliant at getting people off if he paid a hefty fee, you know, because David Beckham also got off with speeding on the bypass, because he claimed he was getting chased by the paparazzi. So that was his story. So there's the skitter story. And
well, that's interesting. You see, I don't remember exactly when this was, but you'll remind me now, because 1987, if that's a you went down to Manchester United, I was going to ask you, had you been in the same team as Wee Gordon, but he would have gone by that time.
No, he was at United.
He was still there.
Yeah, he was at United because he was one of the... When I went down, Gordon was fantastic to me. Yeah, he advised me, good advice right away. He said, look, you should be looking around Wimslow for a house. The only negative of Wimslow is that the manager and Archie Knox's assistant live there, so you're more likely to get caught if you go out to the pub. However, if you go down to the other side, into Hale and Hale Barnes and Bowden, that's where Norman Whiteside and Kevin Moran and Brian Robson live, he said, and I don't think you'll be able to keep up with their drinking. He says, just come with me. He says, we'll be this like quiet couple of pint guys, you know, not. And even a lot of them, the people talk about that drinking culture. It was still a bit of a myth in the sense of they curtailed their drinking activities 48 hours before a game. But they could have a very decent swally, as you say, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But Gordon, so I saw Gordon playing at Manchester United when they came up to play United in the UEFA Cup.
That's right, yeah.
And I remember seeing you, and I think my dad still lived in Dundee at this point. He actually retired to Glasgow, but he had this ambition. He wanted to come to all the football grounds in Glasgow, and he hadn't been to Parkhead. And I might get this wrong, but I think we took him to this may have been later, but I seem to remember taking him to a game and going to, this is not something I would have done very often, but because I was probably still early days in Glasgow, it was a bit of a novelty. And we went to Parkhead to see a Celtic versus Aberdeen game. And I think that was the one where I saw you pick up the ball in your own half and go in the opposite half and score. Would you remember that game?
That was Dundee United.
Was Dundee United?
Yeah.
So maybe it was. That's why, for some reason, that's what I'm saying. I'm getting confused. But I remember, yeah, so maybe that's why I wasn't full of praise at the time, but I kind of grudgingly thought, oh, that's a good goal.
Well, yeah, I do remember the goal because it was one of them where you start off running and you're looking for, I think the problem was that I was looking for somebody to pass the ball to.
There was no one there.
And there was nobody available, so I just kept going from the next one.
Could have passed it to us.
I found myself at the edge of the Dundee United box. I thought, well, I didn't score many goals from outside the box. I think that was from outside the box. And I thought, oh well, I'm here now. I might as well have a go. You know, and I'm not sure if it was Hamish or Billy Thompson that would have been in goals at the time, but they were. It did. I wouldn't say it flew past them, but it went past them. So yeah, that's it.
Seeing as we're talking about Dundee United, I wanted to go back to the sort of beginning, and I was doing a little bit of research, Ricky, into, you know, your time of following the club, and you obviously grew up in a city where there are two clubs pretty much 200 yards apart from each other. But you chose United, and didn't that have something to do with a certain Manchester United supporting relative of yours? Was it?
Actually, yes, absolutely true. Dundee United and Dundee, very close together. And I had an uncle that had come home, and I think we'd attempted to go to Dundee, and we sort of ended up in the old days. Remember the big gates used to open about 20 minutes to go, 15 Aye. Minutes to go to let people out. And we kind of went in there. My uncle was a missionary from Zambia, and he just couldn't believe the bad language. He just thought it was shocking. And that was, he'd sort of put a stop to go to football. But his sons were coming home on holiday. They were in boarding school then in Lancashire. And one supported Everton and one supported Manchester United. And they came home for the Easter holidays and persuaded my mum that they should take me to a football game. And my mum thought football games involved people putting bottles of beer over your head and, you know, and or stabbing you, because that's what her impression of what Celtic and Rangers came up to Dundee was like, everything kicked off. So this was I think it was an end of season game or something like that. And it was Dundee United versus Aberdeen, which, well, these days, I don't, most of the time would be a very big game. For somebody that didn't have a lot of meaning attached to it, I don't think. Anyway, we won 5-0. And I just thought, this is the way things are going to be. Naively. And I support Dundee United. And that at that time, I would say most of the guys in my class, there was always people who supported Celtic and Rangers in Dundee. You'd get that in any sort of Scottish town. But the majority of people supported Dundee. Dundee were the big team. They'd won the league, you know, in the early 60s. They'd been in the European Cup, and they had big crowds and they had big, you know, big support. And they used to kind of slightly laugh at us because we had a sort of diddy ground and, you know, not much of a stand and all that kind of thing. But we were kind of slightly on the up, I think, and there was a significant little minority of us in the school class that supported Dundee United. So yes, it was thanks to my cousin who was a Man United fan. His brother was an Everton fan, and they told me stories of what happened at Old Trafford and Goodison.
What players would have been playing when you first went to see Dundee United?
Well, the guy that scored a hat trick that day was Davy Wilson, who'd played for Rangers.
I think
he went on to manage Partick Thistle. He played for Scotland, obviously. He was a fantastic player. And he was on the wing. I don't know if he was playing that night. He probably came over slightly later. It was Kenny Cameron. And Kenny Cameron played for Dundee. In fact, I think he won the Golden Boot when he signed for us at one point. He scored about 40 goals at some point. Goalkeeper was... what's his first name? Mackay, who later managed Dundee as well, because there was a lot of coming and going between the teams.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
Jimmy.
So you got a lot of Dundee cast offs. Is that what you're saying?
We got a cast off manager. Yeah, I saw Jim McLean, who was obviously Dundee United's manager. I actually saw him playing in a semi final of the Scottish Cup versus. My pal took me up to Muirton, and these days you play the Scottish Cup semi-finals a bit like they did in England at a neutral ground. It was Aberdeen versus St Johnstone, and Jim McLean was actually playing in that game. So yeah, a lot of these guys, Dennis Gillespie, Doug Smith, Don McKay in goals, Andy Rowland would have been around at that time, who was our first ever cap. He got a Scottish League cap. We didn't actually have any players that had been capped for Scotland at that point. So, you know, it was, you're talking about a team that had really not long come up from the old second division.
What did you talk? You talked about the relationship with Dundee and Dundee United there. I mean, you've moved to Glasgow in the years since. I imagine it's a very different rivalry. I mean, you've played Brian with against Rangers for Celtic. I assume it's nowhere near as poisonous as an old firm rivalry.
It's just not similar at all. I remember, in fact, I put it in a line of a song. I wrote a song for Paul Sturrock's testimonial called "I'm Proud to Be an Arab." it was basically a racist slang. Dundee United were called the Arabs or the Arabs. And someone basically started a whole lot of pin badges in the 80s saying "I'm proud to be an Arab," which was great. And in that, I wrote a line about a song about the halftime results going up at Tannadice, and we were actually in a little enclosure near the tunnel, and one of the United staff came out and went, "Dundee had won up at Ibrox." And there was a kind of general feeling of good, you know, because if Dundee were up against Celtic or Rangers, I think all of us were happy. And I would actually go to see United one week, and my dad and I would go and see Dundee the next week, because he'd grown up going to see Dundee. And if it was against Clyde or Morton, we were just glad to see them getting thumped. But if it was against Celtic or Rangers, we wanted them to beat them. And we were doing a gig up in Dundee recently, a charity gig, and I was joking about us going down and Dundee going up, and, you know, the fact that we'd wished to be in, you know, having a sort of derby against each other, because both United and Dundee fans want derbies because it brings more income into the clubs. And I was thinking you could joke about this in Dundee, but if you ever go close at a gig in Glasgow anywhere, like Barnlands or, you know, the Hyde or anywhere, if you ever go close to even alluding to Old Firm kind of things, you just don't do it, you know. Just, it's a bad idea, because no one can sort of joke about it, really. They can in private. Brian will tell you that. I'm sure that there's lots of great chats you'll have with people of opposite sides, totally in private. But in a big situation like that, it just becomes, I would say, wouldn't you, Brian, it becomes,
I think, yeah, I think when you get to things like that, it's a totally different thing, Ricky. So you go to a concert to celebrate the concert together. It's one of the few occasions that the people of the West can actually get together and celebrate the joy of something else. You don't really want then someone on stage, some sort of asking, you know, reminding you of what it's like from day to day, because it's not just about the games whenever they occur. It's something that's, you live in Glasgow now, you know that fine well, you know that it's just something that's there. It's just there, isn't it? It's not a tangible thing, but it's there. So you go a lot of concert to your guest. It's an escapism, isn't it? Like you go to the cinema, you go to the theatre, you go to the football, you know, it's your team. It's your escape from life. When you go into to watch music in the Barlands or anywhere in the other venues in West of Scotland, you want to go there and enjoy yourself and just forget everything that's going on in your life, irrespective of where you're brought up or what football team you're allied to.
There's a famous story of, I think it was Ryan Adams when he first played the Barlands, or maybe one of the times he played the Barlands early on, and someone threw up a Celtic kit. You know, of course, you know, I think you do at the front of the stage, you put it on. And of course, it went nuts, you know. I wasn't there, but I heard the story, and it reminded me of being in Manchester. We were in Manchester in, Brian will tell me the year, and it was a time when Man United still hadn't won that much. Did you win? So I'm trying to think, we would be touring. I think it was 91 we were touring, and we're touring in the autumn. Would that be the League Cup maybe you'd won in the autumn that year?
91? Cup Winners' Cup. In May 91, Cup Winners' Cup.
What did you win in maybe like the December or the autumn? Would that be the League Cup or the Carling Cup or something like that?
No, they wouldn't have been played.
Or maybe, I tell you what, it might be 94. What did they win in 94 in the spring of 94?
The FA Cup. We were in
Manchester. Lorraine had gone out shopping. I think we were doing a couple of nights, going out to the sort of shops. And Man United had won. Put that on in the encore. Put that, you know, 10 bob strip. Put that on in the encore. They all like that. No, they didn't. And that's not to say, and I don't buy that whole bullshit about Manchester being, you know, real Mancunians being Man City fans. All that. It's not true at all. But it is true that there's a big divide. And you just, same as you do in Liverpool. You know, you just don't.
The same thing. But even those things that Manchester and City are not the same as being in Glasgow, it's not the same in Liverpool either, you know. Rivalry tends to be that maybe a day or two before the game, during the game, and then after it's everybody's fairly friendly and go to the, I mean, for example, Liverpool, Matthew lives in Liverpool, so he knows what it's like before and after the games, you know. Whereas in Glasgow, when the Old Firm are playing, it's the only day where every single pub has got a bouncer on. Yeah. And that's right at the very beginning of the day.
That's if they're open.
Well, no, and it depends. The games they always kick off now, early 12 or half 12 now, really. So and there always will be places that you you really can't go into, you know, and there's no colours as well, which is quite right too.
I took my son to an Arsenal-Chelsea game and we sat sitting there kind of going, really? This is like a, you know, it was just so flat. This, you know, and they were both quite up at the time. You know, it was in the Emirates, hadn't been the Emirates. And I went, really? This is a derby.
Ricky, you've already just touched on there, Dundee United's sorry season. So perhaps we should just skate over that.
Thank you.
Happier times. How much do you miss the 1980s and those great Jim McLean days?
Hugely, because unfortunately, I left Glasgow in the 80s. I actually left in the Christmas before we won the league. So I was going back up to see us. And I'd sort of kind of fallen out of love with football in the late 70s. And football, I don't know if Brian's too young to remember this, so you guys probably are, but certainly in the late 70s, football sort of hooliganism sort of just became, it just put me off. You know, people got winning games. You know, even if you're standing there, you just couldn't avoid things. It was before days of segregation as well, which I still think is a shame in some ways that, you know, you can't just stand beside your pal that supports the other team. But anyway, it was just an odd atmosphere and I didn't really enjoy it. So I came through to Glasgow and I still massively loved Dundee United, but I wasn't a regular game goer. And then suddenly we were doing really well. And I was finding myself going up to Dundee or going to a lot of away games. I was going to Morton, going to Parkhead, going to Ibrox and so on. So it was very exciting. And interestingly enough, as soon as the band took off, one of the things that you were able to say when you went to Italy or France or wherever, Spain, was, you know, I'm a Dundee United supporter, and they knew who you were. Because, you know, this is the team that, the year that Brian was talking about, the record came out, this is the team that we beat Barcelona home and away. So we'd beaten all manner of teams across Europe and sort of punched well above our weight. And I think we do, you know, it's funny, Dave Bowman's a pal from these days, and you know, I was mid-season kind of chatting to him by text and he was just saying, we need Jim McLean. You know, it just always needs someone, you know, even though the players really didn't like him. I mean, that's really true, unfortunately. They did not like him. And not in the way that Brian probably jokes about Fergie and players probably joke about Fergie's control and his dominance and so on. I think at the bottom of that, and Brian will correct me if I'm wrong, but whenever you hear Man United players talk, there's deep respect there. And the trouble with Dundee United was Jim was an amazing tactician. He made the team punch well above their weight. But they just didn't really like him and didn't respect him in that way. So, you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for. Management of people has moved on 30 years since these days. So I do wish that we had someone of that ability back, but I'm not sure, Brian can comment on this, I'm not sure that style of, you know, boss management will work these days with young players.
Well, I think what you're saying there, I think the players did respect Jim, but I mean, I just think Jim McLean and Fergie are similar in ways in the sense of how angry they would get and how determined they were to win games. But I had, when you're on the pitch, you don't tend to hear very much of what's going on either in the from any of the coaching staff. When I was a Celtic, when I was in Scotland, say from 81 till 87, but I'd broken my toe, and the game that I came back into the squad was at Tannadice. So you had to go and warm up near the dugout, you know, and that little strip by the side of the pitch. So I was not far away from Jim McLean, and on that side of the pitch was Eamon Bannon. He was playing in the left side of the pitch, so it must have been going up the hill. And I could not believe what he was saying. And he never stopped for the whole of the first half. And he castigated them. And he was calling them a cunt the whole 45 minutes. And I'm like, what is it? And they never stopped for the whole. And then I think the other side, that might have been Ralph Millen's turn, you know, when he played on the right hand side. No, I think maybe I got on the pitch. So I didn't think maybe I got on the pitch somewhere. And I thought, because by then I'd spent some time in under 21s and I and the other people. So I knew I'd come across David Bowman, who who played for Dundee United, and then Morris Malpass and different people. And they would he'd all tell different stories about managers, and they would tell stories about Jim. And you'd be, I would be going, oh, I thought Jock Wallace was bad because I had to tend him for a season at Motherwell, but he sounded... And then I had experience with Jim McLean because in those times when the under-21s coach, you didn't have a dedicated coach. So Jock Stein was a manager of Scotland at those moments when I was in the under-21s. So you had different coaches would take different games. And we played a game, I think it might have been at Dens Park, and the coach for that game was Jim McLean. So we'd had him for the 2 days before in the lead up to the game, and I'd never met him before, you know, and I just thought that naively in a way that I really wanted to enjoy playing football. I'd enjoyed, even although I'd have been shouted at a lot by Jock Wallace and different things. I could not believe, I think we won the game as well, and I couldn't believe the halftime tongue lashing we got from Jim McLean. You know, I just thought to myself, I can't. If I was playing for this guy, I couldn't. I'd have to stop playing because eventually when I went to United and I got hair dryers all the time, you grow a rhino skin, you got used to it and you understood what the reason for it was. But Jim seemed to be at a completely level above
different
things.
Level. Yeah, I mean, the saddest thing for me was in 2010, there was the Dundee United anniversary dinner and I was singing at it. And lots of players, and some of the loveliest guys you could meet in that league winning side, Paul Hegarty, Stephen Neary, Morris Malpass, Hamish. I mean, I'll go through the whole team, obviously, but really lovely guys, and a really warm camaraderie. Johnny Holt, you know, there's a great camaraderie between that team, obviously because they won the league, and they were all of that squad and the squads that came after were on stage, and Jim was given a sort of special award, Jim McLean, and they were all standing behind him, and I was kind of quite near the front because, as I say, I was performing at the thing. I was watching their faces, and there was just no love there in the way that there should have been, really, you know. There was still, and even if you talk to them now, there's a sort of boiling resentment, really, you know. Which you can understand from what the story you tell as well, you know. Because you think of someone like Eamon Bannon, what a lovely guy, and what a bright guy, what an incredibly articulate man. You know, Eamon was the one that was always put out to do the media stuff because he was so good at doing it. And the notion that happens to him, you know, it's just demeaning.
I just thought about Eamon, he went to Hearts after he left Dundee United.
Yeah.
And I know that from people who played at Hearts that Eamon never had a television. He didn't have, I don't know when he was set, but I don't know if he's ever had a television, but I know that when he was playing for Hearts, he didn't have a television. He just read and listened to the music, you know? So I thought that was pretty impressive.
Unlike the kids that I used to teach in Maryhill, when I confessed that I didn't have a TV and they kind of just basically put me down as a complete weirdo.
I thought you were going to say they went and got one from you that out of somebody else's house.
Yeah, quite possibly.
The next day they came in with a television for you.
It was just like, that's bad.
Do you think, for both of you, do you think that Dundee United team under McLean got the credit and the respect they deserve? Because, I mean, Aberdeen get a lot of noise with under Fergie in the 80s, but you were playing against them, Brian, and you were watching them.
There are very, very few games I remember in that six-year period where we had a positive result against Dundee United, either at Celtic Park or certainly at Tannadice. Very, very, very few. I think that maybe the one thing that kind of, for whatever reason, is they lost their European final, whereas Aberdeen won their European final, you know. But if you look at that journey, I bet it was Aberdeen's as well, but you look at the journey from Dundee United, who they played and who they beat, and the style of football, particularly at Tannadice, if you watched back the highlights of those games, which was all you got to see then, they were played some great football and they beat a lot of really good teams. And I think they surprised a lot of these teams by the fact that they were so good, particularly at home.
Yeah, I think they, you know, it's funny, my son always is into football, supports Dundee United now, and, you know, I'll remind him of certain things that happened in football, like Nottingham Forest, you know, winning two, you know, I say, you know, that what you call the Champions League, we call the European Cup, they won it twice. And he looked at me and I said, you know what, Aston Villa won it, you know. And it's funny because there's certain things in that happened in that era in the 80s really that are remarkable. And for whatever, for all the reasons that people think football is improving, and I'm sure there are lots of ways in which it is improving.
Which people?
I'm sure there are aspects of that are true, you know.
That ability
for teams like Dundee United, for Ipswich, for Nottingham Forest, for Aston Villa, you know, for all these things that were possible, are pretty well impossible now. You know, I mean, even winning the league, I think we are the last team outside Celtic and Rangers to win the league. I mean, I can't remember, did Aberdeen win it after that? But certainly Aberdeen, Dundee United, and Aberdeen obviously.
I think you're right. I think Dundee United won the league in 85
We won it in 83. Yeah, this is unfortunately the...
Yeah, I think Aberdeen might have
won it after that. But, you know, around about that time, it was, you know, it was nip and tuck. And then, and even you're talking about Hearts, it was a year, obviously, not long after that, when Hearts were a goal away from winning the league. I mean, these were heady times. And they sort of, even as my boyhood and the way my dad and my uncles and people like that talked, you know, it was almost as if that era had gone as well. And it came back in the 80s, because when I was growing up watching football, it did seem like it was impossible to take on Celtic and Rangers. But suddenly we were. And of course, the whole European stuff was incredible. But I'm just not sure that that's even remotely possible now. I mean, I think it's almost impossible for Scottish teams to get out of the qualifying stages of the European competitions. I'm not talking about Celtic and Rangers here, because I think they're almost in a league apart financially, but the other teams. So yeah, I mean, it was incredible. I think Matthew, the question's right. Certainly we celebrate it. I think a lot of people do recognise it in Scotland, what Dundee United achieved, but it was incredible.
Okay, well, enough about football for just now.
I've just got one more question about football.
All right, go on then, Brian.
I just wanted to know, Ricky, if you were a serial invader of the pitch, or was it just in 1994 at Hampden?
You know, 1994 at Hampden was my moment. And, you know, I always had my defence prepared for that day, because I'd been at six losing Scottish Cup finals. I'd also been at losing League Cup finals. You know what I mean? I'd been through the mill. I'd been through one in 91 when everyone told me it was the best cup final ever, and against Motherwell, it was the worst cup final ever because we should have won it. We didn't. My dad was there. It was his last cup final. And in 94, my dad had gone. He died a few months before. And, you know, by hook or by crook, and I think it was more by a combination of both, really, a bit of luck, not a particularly great Dundee United team, and probably quite a good Rangers team. We were on the way to winning a treble. We won the cup, and I jumped on. My pal, who was a photographer, I said, go and get Davey Bowman over, because I knew Davey well, and I gave him a big hug. And at this point, we were surrounded by three, there's a picture in my book about this, three members of Strathclyde Constabulary, one of whom said, you're the problem. Basically, I don't know what he thought was going to happen. It was going to be a riot.
But, maybe listen to some of the music.
But I just thought, well, if you know, if you arrest me, I'm going to say, look, you know, Your Honour, I've suffered too much for me not to celebrate.
I did hear a story about you. Correct me if I'm wrong, urinating at a Dundee United game because one of your cousins told you that's what happened at Goodison or Old Trafford. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is true. This is a story that my cousins, so one I went to Goodison and one I went to Old Trafford, and they lived in a boarding school just outside Southport, and they got away at weekends to go to these games, and they came back and told me stories, and I saw pictures of George Best and Brian Malone and, you know, all these kind of guys, heard stories of Harry Katrak and Sir Matt Busby and all that kind of thing. And they said, you know, it's really packed in behind the goal at the Stratford end. And I can't remember Gladys Street. And all these sort of places, you know, it's packed. And you can see it on the telly. And they said, you know, it's so crushed that people can't even move. They can't even move to go to the toilet. They just have to pee when they're standing there. And I was about, I don't know, maybe 10 years old or something like that. And I was like, there was something about it just sort of, for some reason, pricked my imagination, you know. And they took me to this, after the Aberdeen game, we went back to another game, and it was against, say, like Dumbarton. I don't even honestly know who it was against, but it was a really meaningless midweek League Cup tie or something like that, beginning of the season. And it was Dumbarton. And we had the, you'll remember before the days of seats, there was what were called crush barriers. I didn't know they were crush barriers because there was never a crush at Tannadice. And I just thought they were putting your pie in your ball, you were people leaning on. And there was two old guys leaning on this thing behind me, and I was at the wall, and it got near half time, and I looked at my cousins and said, you know, I need to go for a pee. And they said, you know, looked at each other, and I said, you know, should I do that thing that you told me about? Because I was quite excited by this idea, you know. And they looked at each other kind of knowingly, knowing that this is a great chance. So I went and just went, yeah. And there I was on the perimeter wall, and Andy Rowland, who's the right back for the United, is going up and down the wing, and I'm peeing against the wall, and there's two old guys behind me in bonnets, you know, the classic old guys. And one says to the other, the laddie doesn't care any better. And I realized at this time that my mother would rather I had been stabbed or had a bottle put over my head, had she known.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I wanted to talk about music because it's something that you, you're both very keen on, as we know. The music scene in Scotland when you were growing up, or in Dundee, particularly when you were younger, Ricky, what was inspiring you to ultimately become a musician?
Well, one of the characters that, funnily enough, one of the people that really inspired me, there was a little gig in not far from the art school where we used to go to called Lanes, and there's a band there called Skeets Bolivar. And they had a bass player called Michael Mara. And Michael ended up with a solo record. And not long before I left Dundee, where I was still working in youth work, I knew about Michael, and I knew about his music, and I bumped into him. And he was incredibly encouraging, and he would write letters to you and so on. And then when we got to a point much later on in Glasgow, I was doing a benefit show, and not long before Deacon Blue really kind of released our first record, and Michael came through and did a show for me, and then eventually came on tour with us and so on. So he was around. I'd heard about this guy. There was a band called Clark's Commandos, and that was a guy who's now a really lifelong friend, Gary Clark, who played with Danny Wilson. And they'd gone away to London. I only know this in retrospect. They'd gone away to London hoping to make it, and nothing happened in London. They came back to Dundee, and this was a classic thing that happened in the 80s. Record companies weren't really interested in you know, bands that were going to London. They were interested in finding out, discovery, what's going on up there, you know, what's going on in the little enclave in the northeast of Scotland. So as soon as they went back up to Dundee, they suddenly got all this interest back. And of course, they ended up getting signed as Danny Wilson. So they were sort of, you know, in and around it. But really, I just came through just friends. I was really involved in the church, and I was playing music with my friends in the youth group, and we were sort of, I was sort of playing a piano and keyboards and stuff like that. And the group didn't really go very far. We sort of became a punk band for about 5 minutes. And then we split up. And then I just started going off and writing songs. So I wasn't really doing much performing. I hooked up with some friends, another songwriter in Edinburgh. And I would go through there and play with him. And then I came to Glasgow and sort of, when I came to Glasgow, I came to join another band, which didn't work out, but as a keyboard player. But I was all the time I was doing this, I was really writing songs. Songs were kind of just happening, and I would just maybe record them on a cassette or whatever. And that was my kind of quiet, you know, into music.
Did you feel you had to go to Glasgow? You had to make that move to, because you were working as a teacher. You had ideas to become a teacher.
I took a job as a teacher, really. I was working as a youth worker, which was my real thing. I really wanted to do that, but I realized that music was kind of plaguing me a little bit. You know, it's a funny thing. And you sometimes meet kids, young people that say, I don't have time to do whatever it is, you know? And I think that's just not true. It's never true, because you will find a hole in your day. You know, if you play guitar, no one will take it off you. You know what I mean? And if you play, sing or play piano, or you want to write songs, no one will take it off you, because you'll find space. And that's what I did. It just got a point where I really wanted to do it. So when I came through to Glasgow, I qualified as a teacher. I didn't want to teach, but I took a job as a teacher just to get some money, and I was playing in the band. So I was on the escape committee, you know, in the school that I was in. From, you know, there's always a wee escape committee in the staff room. You know, what's your plan? I want to be an escape instructor. Okay, there's another guy that wanted to be an actor, and he did. It was great, but I loved it. I actually really enjoyed the school. It was St. Columba Fiona in Maryhill. Still keep up with lots of the staff. It closed down not long after I left. It was a small school. It was a great community school, and it was my first experience of also of real of just in a Catholic environment, which I really enjoyed, and lots of great kids who I still bump into are still very lovely people. One of whom, my great star ex-pupil, now works for the Scottish Government and was responsible for the vaccine rollout last year, Stephen Gallagher, great guy.
Of course, the teaching profession missed out on you as well, Brian, didn't it? Because you could well have been teaching at that school.
That kind of teaching did me, and I ended up, my only ever thought, Ricky, about either dreaming about being a football player was teaching, because it seemed to me a wee bit like you, although I didn't know so much about the potential in the high school. I went to probably the same idea of an escape committee, but the teachers that I had, the inspirational teachers, seemed to be quite happy doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
And also I quite liked the idea of the holidays they got. You know, so not that I'm shy of working at that kind of, I just kind of like this idea, you know. And my kind of favorite discipline was more in maths and physics side of it, but I didn't go on to become a teacher in the sense that you did. But I mean, after I finished playing football, coaching and other aspects, what I did was really teaching football, which allowed me to fulfill that second kind of dream, I suppose, I had. But a question that wanted to ask you about teaching. Is there any point after, you know, all the fantastic things you've done and great events and traveled all over the world, was there any kind of moment at any time you thought, I should have just stayed as a teacher?
not really, in the sense that it wasn't a great time. I mean, I enjoyed it. I've talked about this in my book, I won't bore people with it, but I had an inspirational head teacher who was a really great guy. I had a great head of department and said incredibly inspirational pupils as well at some points. And so there was great moments. I think the trouble was when I was teaching, actually, there was an industrial dispute going on. And for example, people couldn't, you know, one of my pals came and said, do you want to fancy taking a football team on Saturday morning? And we weren't allowed to do it because it was industrial, you know, we were sort of working to rule and all that kind of thing. So there was a lot of things that you would have wanted to do drama clubs, put on shows, that I was an English teacher, you know, that was the kind of thing that you were doing. And it was tricky. So it didn't leave a great sort of aftertaste in that sense. But what I do miss, and I think what you're alluding to, which is really great, I think there's something about being with kids and watching them be inspired, because they inspire you. You know, I used to have a drama lecturer, tutor, you know, who used to say, well, I don't know what it does for them, but it works wonders for me. And I think that's true. And I bet you that's what happened to you when you were coaching kids, because there's something about, I'm a patron of an organization called Musical, which is music for people with multiple disabilities. And on Friday, they did a concert in Glasgow. And I've watched one of the girls in that group from 10 years ago when I first went to see them. Nothing to do with me, by the way. I'm only just a name on the thing, but I tried encouraging them. And they were doing one of my songs, Dignity, on Friday at this concert. So I was introducing this. One of these girls, Shannon, in this, when I first watched this group, had no language. So the only thing she could do was, she had a fantastic time, was beat her head back and forward. And I would go back, and the next day I'd go back and say, well, wait a minute, Shannon's starting to sing. Yeah, well, yeah, she started to sing. And on Friday, she was singing lead vocals with the other lead vocalist. And then I thought, wait a minute, where's that harmony? Shannon's singing harmony. And the next minute, she's introducing a song. So to see that happen through music, you know, is fantastically inspiring. And that, Matthew, is the sort of thing I kind of, you know, I do miss that whole thing where you see people's lives changing for the better and think, gosh, that's great to be part of that. You know, you must have seen that, Brian.
Well, I had 14 years of doing that, and young people inspire you. You know, I mean, yeah. I often, like people say to, well, people talk about this thing that called work. I think of a bit like you, although you did work as an English teacher, though it might have been still fun as well at the time, is that I've never done a day's work in my life, you know. And going in every day, particularly when I was coaching and watching kids was inspirational, you know, because the whole kind of ethos for Manchester United was from me becoming a football player and the journey that I had to the journey of these young players, it's premature professionalism. So you're picking kids of eight, slowly you're looking at them at 6 and 7 years of age, and then you're taking them into your environment and you're signing them on at 8 years of age. And her whole idea was that whether they're there for a day or a week, or they end up becoming football players for Manchester United and their country, more likely to be England, that it should be a pleasure for them and they should enjoy it all the way through. So my kind of thing was that everyone is going to be enjoying it, particularly the coaches. And I used to say to the coaches who were just saying, look, you're coaching these people. I said, in a lot of the cases, I learned quite early on, this is because a lot of the times, at that particular time, the coaches were male. I said, you're going to be the single biggest male influence on these children's life for potentially the next 8 years. And you have to show them that you can enjoy yourself and you can be successful in what you do, because a lot of them are single parent families. I says, and if you don't enjoy what you're doing, they'll find out quite quickly. And if they're not enjoying it, and I find out that you're no use to us anymore. So you have to maintain that enthusiasm and joy you have for football, because they all love football and they love being with kids. And that's the best thing. And like you just mentioned, there are little things that they achieve. You know, I've seen that the other day there, for example, I was just sitting and the television was on where I was, and it was the English Football League's presentation stuff, right? And you can't follow all football from all over the place. So there's enough football on for me to watch. Now, I would watch football every day, but I don't think it's healthy. So I don't really keep up. Yeah, I'm aware that Burnley got up and aware of the playoffs and all the different things. But one of the players that comes up is one of the three is a lad from Burnley called Josh Brownhill. He was at Manchester United as a kid. And I remember there was three young lads in that same team. And we had to tell the three of them that as much as they thought it was a good idea, they had to stop being physical against the other players. There was three of them. No coaching involved in this. Mm. It's just the way there was. And I was walking down the street about 10 years ago, and Josh Brownhill's dad drives a bin lorry, and he stopped in the street. He jumped out, left the bin lorry, ran down the street. I'm Josh's dad. Oh, Brian, how you doing? He'd just gone somewhere and done somewhere on loan. And he said, oh, thanks very much for having you done. Josh is having a really good time. He's enjoying himself. See you. And then the guys are looking over going, what is he doing? You know, because they want to, it's like most people, they want to get their shift on as quickly as they can get back, you know, and these chaps, as far as they're concerned, random guy in the street, you know?
Yeah. So we've both been inspired by what we call Nundy. We've both been inspired by the Scaffies.
Yeah, well, just things like that, you know. So every time again, you see, and I thought, wow, look at him. What he's done for himself. McNeil, who plays for Mark's team, you know, at Everton, he got released at Manchester United as a 14-year-old. I don't think it was my time, it was there, or he wouldn't have been released. And he's gone on through a different kind of route again to becoming a very good, for me anyway, a very good Premier League player who was one of the ones who was responsible for the wonderful season that Everton had last year. You've got to say now it's a good season, Matt. You're still in the Premier League, aren't you?
It is, yeah. Okay, so let's move back onto music, shall we? Ricky, for a period of 4 or 5 years, Deacon Blue just had hit after hit with singles and albums. And I could have sworn that you had at least one number one single. I mean, I would have bet my house on the four Bacharach and David Songs EP getting to number one in 1990. I mean, I bought that single for my 14th birthday. But no, only got to number two.
Yes.
I dare say you can remember what song kept you off the top spot.
I do. And fun enough, the thing about that was we had no ambition. This may sound false, but we didn't really have very much ambition, because what had actually happened was Lorraine had been ill. She had appendicitis. We were on tour in Germany and we couldn't work for a while. And on the way out, we'd had to kind of cancel the tours like maybe earlier in the year. And in 1990. And on the way out the hotel, the guys were just going home. And I was staying on in Germany, obviously, because Lorraine was in hospital. And Jim, our keeper, said, you know, the thing we talked about doing, Bacharach and David thing, maybe we should do that, you know, when we get back. And I said, yeah. So as it happened, Lorraine and I got married in the May. And on the Monday after, when we should have been on our honeymoon, we all went to the studio and recorded that Bacharach and David EP. And the label, Sony at the time, Columbia, just, you know, they were kind of like, well, what are you doing this for? And we said, you know, it's just something I want to do. And if you guys, you know, so that's fine, that's great. All went off on holiday. We didn't make we made a video, but we said, we're not going to be in it. We're all going on holiday. It was so indifferent to the whole thing. It was Talk the Pops. No, we're not going to Talk the Pops. And it was sort of like, you know, no expectations. So then suddenly it was at number two. And we're like, what? And it was going to be at number two for the second week and the third week. And it was, in fact, you're right. It was, Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny. Bye. I can't remember. What's his name? What's his name?
Timmy Mallet. Timmy Mallet, but the band went under the name Bomb Ballerina.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Weirdly enough, we met Timmy. He's a lovely guy. We met him at, in fact, he goes up to Dundee and he paints and stuff like that. And he likes Dundee. We met him in Radio 2, as you do. You meet these kind of people, and he had his mallet with him. So we did a kind of photo op and reserve, you know, but it wasn't as heartbreaking as you might think, because it was just a thing, fun thing to do.
Well, you know, I was in the research for this. I looked back at what was in the top 10 and in the charts at the same time as that particular single, and it is absolutely littered with pop classics that you hear on the radio and that have been covered and have influenced people over the years. So, you know, although it was a bit of a novelty song that kept you off number one, you know, you were in absolutely stellar company at that time.
That's good to know.
Mark's reeling off those hits there that we're talking about. I mean, these are songs that are over, 30 years old now plus.
Yes.
But they're still as popular as ever. And, you know, you're still selling out every year or two. It seems you do these arena tours and people still can't get enough of it. I mean, is it people from that generation, or are you seeing a new audience coming along? Is it?
I guess it must be. I mean, you know, listen, you've got to be realistic. You know, I was at the Springsteen show in Murrayfield recently. I was thinking, you know, it is people of a certain age and the band of a certain age. But I was there with my daughter, you know, and lots of people were there with their kids. My kids have all become Springsteen fans, and one of them went over to Barcelona, one lives in America, went up to Portland to see him. So, you know, you can see how it works. You know what I mean? If your family plays a lot of a certain music, the kids kind of tend to go with it. So I think that happens to us. I don't know what's happened to Deacon Blue. I'm very grateful for it. We made a decision. We were sort of together in the 2000s. I don't know what you call that, 2000 to 2010, but we weren't really doing very much creatively. We didn't make a record. And we came to a point where we think, if we're going to be a band, we need to make records, new records, and we need to be creative. And we made a record called The Hipsters, which I think I'm very, still very proud of, and which now is 2012, sorry. And since that point on, it's like our audience has grown, and we've put out maybe four studio albums and a live album, and I've done solo things. It's been really creative. And I think, whether or not, you know, obviously people come at gigs, want to hear old songs. That's the old joke, isn't it? You know, I'm about to say something in the gig now that no one's going to want to hear. Here's a new song. You know, that's the truth. But I think also audiences that respect bands that are alive and creative and, you know, doing something that they're enjoying. So I think that we've been fortunate in that sense that our audience actually has grown again. So this year, in September, October, we're doing the biggest tour we've ever done. We're going off to Australia to do shows that we didn't expect to be doing, big shows. And then we're going on New Year to South Africa and Spain. And it, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, we're just kind of very grateful that that's happened. So I think that the only thing I can put it down to is that it's kind of like Brian was talking about his coaches. You know, it's like we're happy. I think maybe people are feeding off the enjoyment that we're getting off it, because we are enjoying the creativity. It's a great atmosphere in the band. They're my dearest. Well, one of them's my love of my life and my wife, but the rest of them are brothers to me. You know, that I never grew up with brothers. No, brothers growing up. So these are my closest buddies. You know, and I'm very proud of them.
One thing I always said I wanted to ask you if I ever spoke to you was, what is the relationship between Deacon Blue and Liverpool? Because I'm sitting here about 500. I'm sitting here about 500 yards away from the Echo Arena, as it used to be, the M&S Bank Arena. And whenever you guys are in town, the place just goes nuts, and you can't walk past a pub without hearing Dignity or Real Gone Kid. It's just always fascinating.
Well, I don't really understand it, because when we came back, we did a tour in 2000. We'd split up in 1994. We came back in 2001 and we played the Empire. What's the other one there?
The Royal Court.
And it wasn't sold out. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I remember now it wasn't sold out. And then a few years later, I basically, in the 2000s, did a lot of songwriting, co-writing, you know, for other people. And I was doing a solo tour and I was in Liverpool, and my publisher, my music publisher, was from America. She was working out of the UK, Warner's office, but she was American, so she didn't grow up in the time of Deacon Blue being in the charts and stuff. And she took me out for a drink. She was actually up to talk about renewing my publishing contract, and it was a bit touch and go. And we were walking back from the pub to the gig, and as we were passing the pub, I said, "Oh, that's they're playing one of my songs." She said, "What?" I said, "No, there's a pub band and they're playing one of my songs." She looked at me like, "What the hell?" You know, it's like, I said, I don't know. And then I realized there's something obviously goes on in Liverpool that we hadn't factored on. And I'm not sure what started it. There was one amazing night that we happened to be in the Royal Court in 1989, about a month after Hillsborough. And we got a lot of letters from people saying they'd lost people, or they were at Hillsborough, or someone was meant to be coming to the gig who couldn't be there because they'd gone and died at Hillsborough. And you had to kind of talk about that in the gig. And the gig became a kind of, that way, and only in Liverpool this can happen, is it's sort of the audience becomes the stars, really, of the show. And people started, from the beginning of the show, throwing flowers on stage. There's flowers, flowers, flowers coming on stage. And we had to do a song to talk about this. And we did this song, which was really quite a moment, and we dedicated obviously to the loss of the lives at Hillsborough. And I was at the front of the stage, obviously. And as soon as we finished the song, the entire audience did a rendition of "You'll Never Walk Alone." So I thought, well, we need to get this gig going again, because it's now come to a dead stop. You know, it really is. It's almost too emotional. And I turned around the band to say, you know, let's get the gig going again. And the entire band were just in pieces. You know, it was so emotional. Of course, I mean, just terrible stuff. And it still affects it. So whether there was something about that night that carried us with people of Liverpool, but for some reason we've made a connection to the city. And we're hugely grateful for it, because it always feels like home when we come there. I have to say it. Also have a great connection with Manchester, with Newcastle, with Birmingham, you know, but there is something special in Liverpool, and it just made
me laugh, because you obviously tour as a solo artist sometimes, don't you? Just you at the piano telling stories, and you know, which is a great tour. I've seen you do it. I saw you do it at New Brighton a few years ago, and I felt a little bit sorry for you, because I felt the audience there were just desperate for you to do Real Gone Kid or Dignity. And I think at one point you were like, look, this isn't that kind of gig. We're playing at the arena in September. Come and see us then. You know, you almost had to tell them to calm down, which I think must be a difficult balance for you as an artist, but it's great to be able to have the two performances.
Yeah, I think actually I played at the Philharmonic in September then. It was wonderful, really one of the best nights ever. And it kind of, people had got got what the show was and wasn't, and it was lovely, you know.
Yeah. No, I remember it well.
Ricky, you've also been turning your hand to radio, and you've got a show on BBC Radio Scotland called Another Country, which explores the landscape of Americana. How did that all come about?
Actually, kind of weirdly, I was in doing an interview with the BBC, and an old friend of mine, Stuart Cruikshank, God rest his soul, he's a great producer, really, I mean, just a total music guy who would just do loads of stuff about music and lots of bands in Glasgow and Scotland, really. We just talked very fond of Stuart. And I was chatting to him one day, and I said, yeah, I'd love to do a radio show. You know, like, you know, I just said it, and he said, oh, leave it with me. And he phoned me up a few months later and said, listen, the late night show goes out for me and Anderson. He's going off on holiday for a couple of weeks. How'd you fancy depping for the show? So I did, and they seemed to quite like it. And the controller at the time said, we're going to have a 6-week break in the radio, and we're going to give everyone a chance to have a show. So they gave me a late night show, which wasn't really perfect because for various reasons, but I survived it. They didn't pull me off air. And about one thing led to another. They asked to do a sort of specialist show, which is called Specialist Show, which was called the Ricky's American Tunes. And we kind of did that. And then a guy arrived up from Radio 1 and said, we're going to recommission the show, but we want to make a country and Americana show. This is about 2008. And a guy arrived up from Radio 1 called Richard Murdoch. He's been my producer for the last 15 years. We met in the canteen, and I said, do you know anything about country music or Americana music? He went, no. I said, well, neither do I. Let's take it from there. And we kind of did. I mean, I did. It's not true that we both loved certain things. You know, we both knew. I mean, I certainly grew up loving Graham Parsons, Emma Harris, and all these kind of things. But, you know, below that, I didn't really know very much at all. And I think in some ways that's been the secret, is that we don't try and bluff anyone, and we just try and play things that we love. And there's so much stuff to play. I mean, so many great artists to play, and we've been just so lucky. Because by the time that Americana country artists come to us, they've got loads of experience of doing things. So they're great interviews to do, because, you know, it's not like interviewing a shoegazing band who just want to be cool. You know, they will tell you stories and be engaging and funny and all the rest of it. So, you know, I'm very grateful doing it tonight, live tonight again on a Tuesday night. No one's found us out yet. So here's open.
I've just got one question for you then to finish. Then you got, I've given you an option of your last ever gig with as Deacon Blue, right? And here's the options for you: Glastonbury or Kilmarnock Jail.
Do you know what? I love playing Kilmarnock Jail. Playing in the jail, we did play Kilmarnock Jail. That's what Brian's alluding to. The thing about playing in the jail now, I have done gigs in the women's jail. I've done solo shows in Shorts. The jail's a different place these days. So many people are kind of just, you know, in the old days, if you do something in the jail, oh, everyone's there, you know, because there's nothing happens in the jail. The trouble is now, so many, when we played it, I was talking to one or two of the staff and saying, you know, the guys now, a lot of them, there's so many drugs in the jail and so on. It's just, you know, they're kind of not even engaged with that kind of the idea of a gig is not what it should be. Prison's a very sad place. I think people, I hate people that criticise prisons without going into them. You know, and when we did the gig, it was interesting. People said to me, why are you doing that for them? I said, well, do you ever go into jail? Do you ever know why people are there? You know, there's a whole lot of people in prison that shouldn't be in prison for a start. So it was a special place. I don't want to say that. But Glastonbury, which we might have been playing this year, but we're not. But Glastonbury in 2011, when we played it, was actually, that was the rebirth of Deacon Blue, and it was a magical night. And I've talked about that in the book, and I've talked about it also on stage. It was something special. It was that the acoustic tent became the Barrenlands, and I don't know if you can ever go, you know, you can't go home again, you can't do that gig again, but I would give it a good shot, Brian.
Life with Brian, life with Brian.
It's that time again when we spring a quiz on Brian and our unsuspecting guest. Ricky, Deacon Blue may have spoken about a ship called Dignity in their anthemic 80s hit, but we've got a ship called Man City. Allow me to explain. From the 1930s into the 1960s, the Consolidated Fisheries Company of Grimsby began naming 29 of their fishing trawlers after football clubs. So we're going to give you 5 alternate names in the penalty shootout format, and it's your job to spot the prize catches from the red herrings. So if you think each club had its name on the back end of a fishing boat, please say aft. And if you think it's total codswallop, say daft.
Okay. After.
Are we clear?
After. I've got it.
Okay. All right.
Ricky, you two need our guest. Something better to do with your time.
And that is true. We need to get a hobby other than this.
Who's idea?
This one. This is perfect.
Oh, right. Okay.
If it's a joint venture, okay. Isn't it, Mark?
It was. Okay, Ricky, as our guest, you get the honour of launching the quiz. And your opener is Dundee United.
Were they on the back of a Grimsby trawler?
Exactly.
I'm going to say aft.
Sorry, but it's daft. You've missed your first penalty. It seems that none, of, aft, their, well, even if none of their boats,
well,
none of their
loss.
Boats were named after Scottish clubs. Yeah.
Okay, Brian, your chance. You're kicking off with, quite aptly, Manchester United.
Aft.
0 for 2. Daft. There was a Man City, but not a United.
Ask us that question again.
No retake, sorry. Okay, Ricky, your second boat is Notts County.
Well, something going to say something like Hartlepool, and I was going to go for it. Notts County, I'm going to go aft because they were like the first club in the league or something like that. So surely.
Well, it's reasoned logic, but you're right, it's aft. The Notts County boat, it came a cropper at the hands of German U-boat 701 in World War II.
Okay, Chucky, pressure's on now. Your second fishing vessel is the Leicester City.
Daft,
did you say?
Daft.
Okay, well, you went the wrong way because it's aft. The boat, like its namesake this season, ran aground and was lost forever.
Well, it was nowhere near the sea. Why is it called after that?
Yeah, okay.
Don't argue with us. Ricky, just giving the answers.
Ricky's got the initiative, hasn't he? Right, Ricky, to extend your league, extend your lead even, your third one is Real Madrid.
Real Madrid from Grimsby. They're not going to want a Real Madrid. They want, they want Lincoln City. I'm going to say daft.
You spurned your opportunity to go to
Did
it?
Did it?
Yeah, unfortunately, the Real Madrid was the only one of the football trawlers named after a foreign club.
Bloody glory hunters.
What happened to it?
I don't know. I didn't do that much research. Like I said, I've got a wife and kids to deal with. I can't spend the whole day looking through fishing registries.
Well, you pretty much did.
You should let Matthew do it. He's got nothing else to do.
That's true.
Right. Okay.
Ryan, number three for you is Liverpool.
Aft.
This is an awful shooter. This is like the 1986 European Cup final. Now Bucharest. Against Barcelona, daft. No Liverpool, but there was an Everton who seemed to be doing something of an who was something of an unsinkable ship. Isn't that right, Mark?
Yeah, that's right. We're doing what the Titanic couldn't. Okay, Ricky. So your fourth penalty is Plymouth Argyle.
Coastal. I'm feeling it. I'm going to say aft again.
Oh, we've given you the eyes there. It's a daft. It's not a boat, despite being one of the UK's top fishing ports. Consolidated Fisheries
maybe
decided
rival,
not
that's
to name
it
one of its boats. So there you go. So I think we're still at 1-0 to Ricky.
1-0, yeah. And the penultimate penalty for you, Brian, is one of your old clubs, almost Aston Villa.
Daft.
Did you say daft?
Yeah.
Yes. Finally, another vessel that saw active service. During World War II, it sustained too much damage from the enemy off the Norwegian coast to make it home and was sunk by fire from our own forces. But it's
1-1. Yeah, so Ricky, your final.
It's a litany of disaster, really, isn't it? This quiz. Yeah. I'm getting more depressed.
It is, yeah.
Getting sunk.
Yeah, so Ricky, your last one is Port Vale.
I've gone aft every time, so I'm going to go again.
After you've chosen right, well done.
Keeper died the wrong way.
The Port Vale had a long life, which included being involved in some tricky encounters with Icelandic vessels during the Cod Wars of the 1970s.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to enjoy that news on the news. I was an avid watcher of that. Well, there's nothing else to watch. You had to watch it.
You've got to concentrate now, Brian, because you could make this 2-2. Sorry. And you get to finish with the shootout with Derby County.
Daft.
D?
Daft.
You skied it. That's despite Derby being just about as far from any sea as you can be in the country. They did have a ship named after them. So Ricky is the victor, 2-1.
Well done, Ricky.
I think we did all right. I have to let you into a secret. My idea for the quiz was Fergie Sings the Blues, and I was trying to find out what music Alex Ferguson listens to, which and then do like a true or false, but I couldn't find it anywhere. So,
what music he listens to?
Yeah,
Frank Sinatra.
Yeah,
that's he loves all. I needed Matt 10. Monroe.
I needed 10.
All of them, Matt Monroe, all of those kind of people.
I knew
Martin, all of that.
Push. I knew I couldn't ask you. give the game away. It was one of those where the title of the quiz was better than the actual idea. But
we had a debate, Ricky was asleep with us, with Alex Ferguson talking about music. He was always doing that. You know, he'd sort of half start singing some. He could sing, I can't sing at all, but he could. You could tell it was a tune, you know, but it's a few little words and then it'd be the doobie doobie doos and all this kind of thing, you know. And he clearly didn't pay that much attention to it, but at United, when it first, I don't know if it first started or it was always there from 86 or 87, but United used to come out onto the pitch to Tina Turner's Simply the Best.
Oh, did they? I didn't know.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. Another
team took it.
well, I pointed it out to him, right? And I don't know if you've seen the film, or Fergie's film, but yeah, he certainly, when he was a manager and at the end of his playing career, he was not very, a fan of Rangers, you know? So I just have to mention, you know, that. You know, I says, you know that there's the song we come out to. He goes, what is it? You know, because he didn't know it was Tina Turner or whatever. I says, it's the Rangers come out to that at Ibrox, you know. What? We're not bloody having that. We're not having that again, right? So I thought that's quite good then. So there was a thing about we're going to have a new song, you know. And he kept coming out with all these Matt Monroe and all this. And I'm going, this is not inspiring. You might think it's good and all this stuff and all that stuff. And I'm going, we can't be having this. And they go, you just fucking pick one.
So you picked the Stone Roses?
Yeah.
So it's you?
Yeah.
I'll tell my son this. He loves that. Yeah.
Yeah. So
if we're going down to Manchester and he's going to a game, he's blasting it from upstairs and he's getting into the atmosphere. So he's a big Man United fan. So that's good to know.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. Another of them achievements, the 3-inch pass and picking a good song.
Mm. Nothing like the Zed Cars tune, though, lads. I've got to tell you, that's still the best.
Oh, well.
Oh, you're playing to the gallery now, Ricky.
Mucklass mailbag.
Yeah, what's dropped through our letterbox for Brian and Ricky, Matthew?
Okay, Ryan Coyle is first out the mailbag with this one for Ricky, and he's put you right on the spot here. He said, if Brian McClare was a song, any song by any artist, which song would it be?
any song by any artist, which song would it be? Oh, my goodness. I have no idea. But it has to be a good one. It has to be a good one. It has to be one that lasts. So I'm going to give him...
Pick My Way, because I know what you think about My Way.
I'm going to pick you a Salford song, since you're kind of a Salford lad these days, I guess. I'm going to pick you Dirty Old Town.
Oh, what a good choice.
Oh, yes.
Yes, what a good choice.
For being put on the spot, you did well there.
No, that's magnificent, that, yeah.
Okay. Ross Smith has a couple. First one for Ricky. What was the reason for mentioning the drink Racky in Dignity rather than any other drink?
Well, it was probably ignorance, really, but I wrote the song on the island of Heraklion, Crete, and I didn't actually have ever had raki, but I just kind of searched around and what is it the drink here kind of thing. And then when we first did a TV show, someone put a map of Turkey on the background, so someone said they drank raki, so it was all about just being abroad. It was just home thoughts from abroad, all that kind of stuff.
Fair enough. And his second question, and you alluded to this a few minutes ago when we were talking about Tina Turner, he said, why did you choose Manchester United as your English team?
I don't really. I mean, I have to say, when I was growing up, I kind of liked Spurs. I had a Subutio team that had Fulham, Spurs, and an Aston Villa. But what actually happened was And I always followed the Scottish guys when they came to England. And so I really did actually like Liverpool a lot because of Kenny Dalglish and Liverpool. But because of Bill Shankly. And I suppose Man United got into the soul of lots of us because of Matt Busby and then, of course, Fergie. So we were always interested in the Fergie story. So my pals and I always really just kind of followed the results and talked about and liked them in Europe and all that kind of thing. And then when my young lad was, we were in Manchester one day, and Alex McLeish, who I knew a little bit, had set up for me to go and visit Carrington Training Ground with my young boy, who was 7 years old. And of course, if you go and meet Fergie and you're Fergied, and you have that kind of moment and you meet some of the players, he became a Man United fan for life. So I tend to go down and see them. But I do have to say, I'm very fond of, I know you can't be a Man United fan and a Liverpool fan, but I'm a Dundee United fan, really. I like to see Man United and I like to see Liverpool doing well. I actually like to see Everton doing well too. I've got a real soft spot for all these clubs. I can't say that for Man City, really, to be honest with you. You know, I don't support teams from Abu Dhabi.
Fair enough. Questions from Stuck in the 80s. Sent one for Ricky. Football dressing rooms are notorious for giving stick to their teammates. Are bands the same?
No, it's got to be much more subtle. There could be kind of moments in the, you know, when gigs went wrong and people would be. There was a famous Deacon Blue one, something in Australia, which we all quote. It's very funny. But it was an after-show buffet of sort of cold chicken and various other things, and it was getting a bit heated in the dressing room. And someone, not me, but someone said to one another, two guys were having it out about something going wrong, and one said to the other, "Don't shake the chicken leg at me." And we kind of thought, is that some sort of expression? You know, if you shake the chicken leg, does that mean it's war? So it's become a bit of a mess. But no, we don't really know. No, we tend to just be knackered and have a beer.
Okay. Melanie Engelbrecht wants to know, Ricky, is it a comfortable experience as an artist to delve deep into the back catalogue, particularly B-sides, or can it sometimes be difficult?
I always think songs are a bit like kids, you know, you always love the ones that no one else loves, you know. You know, if you've got four kids and one of yours because it's badly behaved, it's certainly you like them more. So I'm always kind of, it's funny, certain songs just never make it. You know, they never make, to use Brian's language, they never make it off the bench. They never make it in the squad, never mind off the bench. So you're often very fond of songs that have just somehow just slipped away and never quite got there. So yeah, I still have a slight longing for certain songs that I always felt should have been maybe more part of the repertoire than they are.
Any particular you want to mention?
Well, there's a song that we did recently called Back Here in Minoland, which actually was the B-side to Real Gone Kid, and I always felt that, you know, I got that right. And the first ever B-side of the Deacon Blue did, Riches, I would say is probably the most correct song. And it was written for a friend who died. And I look back and think, actually, I got that one right. Sometimes you look back and think, well, I didn't quite get that. But I think with Riches, I got that one right.
Fair enough. And finally, we got a question from our good friend Cumbrian Dave, who I know for a fact is coming to see you in Liverpool on September the 15th, is it?
It's opening night.
Yeah, he said he's
15th.
He said he's coming to see you, so he'll be there, and here he is.
Hello, guys. Hope everyone's doing well. Question for Ricky. Out of all the songs that he's co-written with other artists, which is his favourite?
Just trying to think. I think probably High, you know, I wrote with James Blunt because it kind of just went places that I never thought a song could go. It was a massive, it was a follow-up to You're Beautiful for him, or in fact, it was a prequel to that because he put out first and then put out again. So probably that one. And I like the song. Yeah, we'll go with that.
Nice one. Okay, I'll tell him when I see him next.
If you tell Cumbrian Dave.
Okay, all done.
Yeah, and with that, I'm calling closing time on this episode. So let's say our goodbyes and thanks to our wonderful guest, Ricky Ross. It's been brilliant, Ricky. What does the summer hold in store for you and Deacon Blue?
Summer, for me, the big thing in the summer is my youngest daughter, the third daughter, is getting married. So she's the third one to get married in August. So that's a big, big event. It's going to happen not so far away from here, which is good as well. Actually, we've just been in Donegal. Lorraine and I have just been in Donegal, and we love this so much. I'm actually going over to do a book event at Seamus Heaney's Book Festival in Ballachie in Northern Ireland, and we decided just to go back to Donegal again for a few days. It's just a magical part of the world. I don't know if you've ever been. So we were swimming off in the Atlantic, and it was just great. So a bit of swimming in the Atlantic, a bit of wedding, and then we're off on tour.
Did I see today, just a few hours ago, you've been announced to play Radio 2 in the park in Leicester?
Yeah, we are. We're going to be doing that as, I think, almost like right at the start of the tour. It was going to be a day off, I think. It's no longer a day off, but it'd be brilliant. Yeah, that's just been announced today. So look forward to that as well.
And you mentioned one of your daughters there. I've got a very tenuous link through one of them. I'm not sure which one, that my brother-in-law taught one of your daughters to drive.
Did he? He did. And how is his recovery from all that?
The counselling's going well.
Yeah. Tell him whatever he does, don't do my son, because that would actually maybe send him into a long treatment program. He's learning at the moment.
Brian and Matthew, good stuff, chaps. See you next time, eh?
It's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for having me, guys. Brian, it's lovely to see you. Thank you. Brian, hopefully thank catch you. Up in the flesh at some point when you're up the road.
Aye, that'd be great, aye.
And I'll sign off with our thanks to you for listening. Please subscribe to Life with Brian on your preferred podcast platform. We're on pretty much all of them. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Brian McClare Pod. We will be back very soon with more from Chockey, Matthew, myself, and, of course, another guest. We look forward to seeing you then. Ta-da.
Life with Brian, talking films or music. Life with Brian, talking TV and food. Life with Brian, talking trivia and exercise. Life with Brian is different every episode. Life with Brian, talking politics and football. Life with Brian is different every episode. Life with Brian, life with Brian.
Podcast Network.